Queen Elizabeth, as we reflect on the end of the second Elizabethan era, with pageantry in this last week that nobody has seen in our lifetimes, absolutely extraordinary. One can only think about the other Elizabethan era. And yes, we are seeing something that's so extraordinary. Evidently, people's interest and support for tradition and for monarchy and for Christian nationalism is much greater than had been anticipated before, and there's still phenomenal support on the ground. To think that 4 billion people worldwide on this last Monday, the 19th, watched a traditional Christian message or listened to it, radio, TV, 4 billion people. This is the greatest media event of our lifetimes. Greatly eclipsing, almost double the amount of viewers as were for Princess Diana's funeral just 25 years ago. And although there were weaknesses, nevertheless, excellent military precision, some great Christian hymns, and great scriptures read, and military precision like I don't think anyone's seen before. I think the only way they could have improved this is to have had the Rhodesian Light Infantry in its heyday in this procession as well. But extraordinary history with all of this. And by the way, there's a lot of interesting anecdotes. If you want to know the origin of the red coats, that comes from Oliver Cromwell. He introduced the red coats in the first professional British army. And the Coldstream Guards is a direct descendant of the new model army started by Oliver Cromwell during the English Civil War in the 1600s. The very first professional army in history of Great Britain for sure. And he chose red so that the enemy would not see you bleed. Interesting that such a non-royalist would have been the origin of the epitome of royalist guards. But these are scenes that just show the seriousness with which Britain takes its tradition and heritage. And in a world of secularization and a world of globalization, it's good to see some resistance. And this is greater than any person or any family. The monarchy and these traditions, they go back centuries. And the uniforms and the pageantry and the ceremonies and the ritual and the prayer book even, they all go back centuries. And the fact that in this secularized, globalist, superficial, shallow, Hollywood-type world, the world has been given a bit of a glimpse at an age of the past, but hopefully also a view to the age to come, when the world will return to roots of family, faith, flag, and a lot to reflect upon and a lot to reflect on what we have lost over the years. But that is a good quote. Grief is the price we pay for love. In Belfast, Northern Ireland, they call it the largest outdoor art gallery in the world. And I've been in Shankill Road, and this is Sandy Row, where they've got these wall murals which are always declaring the allegiance of the people to the throne. I don't think they're more dedicated loyalists and royalists anywhere in the world than on Belfast, Northern Ireland. But look at these flower tributes to the Queen. Just extraordinary. 4 billion people watched the program and 2 million lined the parade streets in London. So what can we learn from the original Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth I, the Protestant Tudor queen, under whom the Protestant cause flourished? And Shakespeare wrote his influential and historic plays. And the Royal Navy grew in strength and skill and global influence. And the Spanish Armada was decisively defeated. And under whom a great era of exploration led to the establishment of colonies in the New World of North America. And who laid foundations for foreign missions, which later led to the evangelization of the world and the greatest century of missions in the 19th century. And also during the Elizabethan era in the 16th century, the Puritans produced some of the greatest literature and movements for freedom which continue to affect the world to this day. How many of you would have seen the film Elizabeth or Elizabeth the Golden Age? Anyone? Oh, well, I guess I was going to ask questions how the film deviated from the real history, but if none of you have seen it, that would be kind of hard to do. But the epic film Elizabeth, The Golden Years, which is a sequel to the earlier Elizabeth, inspired greater interest in this famous queen and the tumultuous times in which she lived. And numerous friends asked just how much of the films were accurate history and how much was Hollywood fiction. And well, a lot of it was Hollywood fiction. But in fact, some of the greatest stories were still not told. But it's just, it's not bad that they gave a bit of an inkling, but they put so much fiction into these films, you're not missing much by not having seen it. The fact is, Elizabeth I was England's greatest queen. Now, I've heard people saying on the BBC and so on that Queen Elizabeth II is the greatest queen in British history. I don't know how they can say that, because she did not have the same power, nor did she have the choice to be controversial. Therefore, how can you compare? How can you be great when you're not allowed to be controversial and when you don't hold absolute power? Without a doubt, King Alfred the Great and Elizabeth I were the greatest monarchs Britain's ever had. And some people say Elizabeth I was the greatest of all, which is possible. There is no doubt Elizabeth I was England's greatest queen. She came to the throne of a country deeply divided between Catholic and Protestant, a country economically bankrupt, devastated by the persecutions and oppressions of a whole sister, Mary Tudor, the infamous Bloody Mary, whose fanatical obsession to return England to Catholicism so spectacularly backfired. Bloody Mary condemned hundreds of prominent English Protestants to death by burning at the stake. This commemorates seven men and women burned at the stake at Coventry for the crime of teaching their children the Ten Commandments, the Lord's Prayer, and the Apostles' Creed in English. She had the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, burned at the stake in Oxford. And the most famous Protestant theologians and preachers, Bishops Ridley and Hooper and Latimer, and the Bible translator John Rogers, and hundreds of others, burned at the stake. Many of them in Oxford. The saying was, Cambridge produced the reformers whom Oxford burned. But Queen Elizabeth ushered in a true golden age. Under Queen Elizabeth's 45 years reign, England was united, strengthened, entrenched as a Protestant nation, prospered, flourished, and it defeated the greatest military superpower of the age, Spain. Now, bearing in mind that at that time, England had something like 3 million population, and Spain had something like 60 million, and there were hundreds of millions under Spain's dominion, it was not predictable that this little bankrupt island would ever become a world power. But that happened under Elizabeth. Under Elizabeth, England experienced a renaissance of art, literature, and architecture. Hers was an age of great men. During her reign, William Shakespeare, perhaps one of the most famous writers of all time, began a 20-year career in the theatre, during which he wrote 38 plays, containing more than a million words of beautiful poetry that have been recited over and over by great actors throughout the centuries worldwide. I don't know how many of the 38 plays you've read. I think I can only say I've read six of them, and probably seen a couple of others depicted at plays. But I remember my wife coming through to me quite irate at one point, saying, Andrea, who's 11 years old, had been caught after lights out, reading by torchlight under her blankets Shakespeare. And I was meant to go and discipline her. So, outstanding, Andrea, excellent, can I give you a bit of torch? I mean, how can you rebuke your daughter for reading Shakespeare at age 11? Outstanding. Excellent. I was told that I'm encouraging ill-disciplined rebellion. Well, that's the kind of rebellion we want. Yes. Read books. Read Shakespeare. Excellent. Absolutely outstanding. In Westminster Abbey, the very abbey where Queen Elizabeth was married, crowned, and had a funeral service, to the left, there is what they call Poet's Corner, and you can see dominating it is William Shakespeare, and quite a few other Puritans and other writers and playwrights from the Elizabethan era. Great seamen, great explorers, such as Sir Francis Drake and Sir Walter Raleigh, Elizabeth's sea dogs, sailed the seas and plundered the Spaniards, of course, as well. The decisive victory over the Spanish Armada signaled the rise of the Protestant naval powers of England and Holland, and the decline of Catholic naval superpower of Spain. And that's very important, otherwise we wouldn't be here in the Cape, would we? It was during the reign of Elizabeth that North America was first claimed for the Protestant cause, with Sir Walter Raleigh naming Virginia after the Virgin Queen Elizabeth of England. And he pioneered the first settlements in North America. And that is wonderful because the Catholics got to the Western Hemisphere first, but they went for the more pleasant climes of Central America and South America, and they left the harsher climates of North America alone, which left them for the Protestants to claim. Just like when the Catholic Bartholomew Diaz and Vasco da Gama came around the Cape, they left the Cape of Storms, which is what the Portuguese called it, because this wasn't very nice. They lived in the Mediterranean climate, Portugal. They chose rather Angola and Mozambique, Portuguese East and West Africa, and left the harsher climate of South Africa for the Protestants to claim, under especially the Netherlands. So we can praise God for that providence. Elizabeth had a truly terrifying upbringing. She was born in 1533 to a very cold reception from her father, King Edward VIII, who had wanted a male heir to carry on the Tudor line, and was deeply disappointed at the birth of his daughter. Not that he was to realize she was to become far greater than him, and probably the greatest monarch of all time in Great Britain. Elizabeth's mother, Queen Anne Boleyn, was beheaded, condemned to death, and beheaded on the scaffold for treason. Probably her main crime was failing to produce a male heir. Elizabeth was only 2 years old when her mother Anne was executed. I mean, how can one even comprehend your father killing your mother? I mean, what kind of upbringing is that? As a child, Elizabeth experienced more sorrow and loneliness, bitterness, fear, and terror than any child should experience. From her earliest day, the fear of sudden death was always with her. Here's the spot in the Tower of London where the scaffold was, where Queen Anne was beheaded, and a whole lot of others, including her stepmother, Catherine Howard. Catherine Howard adopted and looked after and raised her, and also raised in the Protestant faith, and she gets beheaded as well. In fact, the way to remember King Henry VIII's marriages, he had six wives, divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. I mean, that's the summary of the six wives of King Henry. And so Elizabeth realized, I mean, you wonder why she never got married. She realized that to get married is incredibly dangerous. I mean, it cost her mother her head, it cost her stepmother her head. How many people died as a result of falling into disfavor, and she realized how dangerous it was to be married, and she never wanted to lose her freedom and her power. So Elizabeth spent much of her early years in virtual imprisonment. In fact, she was even locked up in the Tower of London by her half-sister Mary. But she was surrounded by good tutors, she did have plenty of books, and she had the company for much of the time of her young stepbrother, Edward, who shared her Protestant faith. In 1547, when Henry VIII died, Edward VI, her half-brother, then aged 9, ascended to the throne. By Henry VIII's will, Mary Tudor, daughter of Catherine of Oregon, that's what today we call Spain, stood next in line of succession after Edward. So Mary's mother was Spanish and Catholic, obviously. And Mary was a pathological Catholic. And so Henry had one son, so he was first in line, and then he had his daughters second and third in line. After Mary, Elizabeth, so she is now third in line for the throne. However, in France, there was a menace to all of them. Mary Stuart, who was granddaughter of Henry VIII's older sister, Margaret, depicted here as Margaret. And Mary Stuart was wife of the Dauphin of France. Now, just like the Prince of Wales is the heir to the throne in England, the Dauphin is heir to the throne in France. Mary Stuart was also heir to the throne of Scotland. She is married as a teenager. She is widowed as a teenager. She was on the throne of France for a few months. And she was a dedicated Roman Catholic. And now she's coming back to Scotland. Funny how many of these Mary, Queen of Scots films have her speaking a broad Scottish accent, which is next to impossible. Because she first came to Scotland at age 20. And she had been speaking with a French accent at best. Highly unlikely that she even spoke good English at all, let alone Scottish, and definitely not with a Scottish accent. Mary Stuart, also known as Mary, Queen of Scots, posed a serious, deadly, clear and present danger to not only Elizabeth, but to the Reformation, all the peoples of England, because unless and until Elizabeth married and had an heir to the throne, Mary Stuart was next in line to the throne after Elizabeth, which meant England was a hairbreadth away from a Catholic queen. And after what they had to suffer under Bloody Mary, Mary Stuart would have just been disastrous. Edward VI's premature death in 1553, I'm convinced through poison, it led to plots and intrigues. He died at just age 15. Counterplots. Edward VI, prior to his death, had changed the laws of succession that his father had set in place, which he had the right to do as the king, in favour of his cousin Lady Jane Grey, who was a serious, dedicated Protestant. Desperate to avoid the religious persecution that would surely come with his Catholic half-sister Mary, Edward endeavoured to ensure this dedicated Protestant Lady Jane Grey, who was a brilliant, intelligent girl. If you read in Fox's Book of Martyrs, you can actually see pages and pages of the brilliant testimony of Lady Jane Grey, arguing with the best minds of the Catholic Church in England, and being able to defend articulately the Protestant faith and refute the Catholic heresies. So Lady Jane Grey should be the next queen. She was the nine-day queen, but Bloody Mary's reign of terror came after that. Tragically, the courageous young Lady Jane Grey, or Queen Jane, was betrayed, and Mary, the first daughter of Henry VIII, became Queen of England, and like her mother Catherine of Aragon, Mary, Queen Mary, or Bloody Mary, Mary Tudor, was a fervent Catholic and determined to force England back to Catholicism. Bloody Mary began a relentless campaign against the Protestants, and it was severe. And her cousin Lady Jane Grey was beheaded. She gave Jane, her cousin, the choice. Convert to Catholicism and you can save your life. Don't convert to Catholicism, you'll be beheaded. At age 15, Queen Jane stood firm, and I think she was 16 by the time that they'd run out of patience with her and they beheaded her. And her young 16-year-old husband, who she'd just married. Prominent bishops, reformers, Bible translators were burned at the stake. Hundreds of them. Much of them in Oxford. For five tragic years, Bloody Mary sought to bludgeon the people of England back to Rome. But it was more severe than that, because there was a Spanish connection. Basically, England and Spain had married. Now, Mary was half Spanish, and now she's married to the King of Spain. So that meant any virtual would be three-quarters Spanish. England could just be a province of Spain. As there was a time that Holland, the whole of the Netherlands, was a colony of Spain. The same Prince William of Orange, after whom our Orange Free State and Orange River is named, was the man who fought for the independence of the Netherlands from Spain. England could have been in the same position, being a province of Spain too. Mary's marriage to Philip II, remember the powerful Habsburg family, brother Ferdinand, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was effectively the EU of that time, endangered not only the Protestant Reformation, but the very independence of England. England was about to have a Spanish royal family and be completely subjugated to Spain. Philip II was soon to become King of Spain, who was a fanatical enemy of Protestants. Philip II made it known that his goal was to conquer the entire world for Spain, the Roman Church, and that was not unrealistic. He already controlled almost all of Central America and most of Southern America. Philip II became the husband of Mary and the King of England in 1554. In 1556, he officially became King of Spain. So they had a King of England, a King of Spain. However, by God's grace, the marriage was fruitless. Mary died without having conceived a child, for which we can all be very grateful, or history would be extremely different. The Counter-Reformation was very counterproductive. Here you see the Archbishop of Canterbury, first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, being brought through Traitor's Gate into the Tower of London, in preparatory for being tortured and ultimately stripped of all of his titles and shaved, his fingertips shaved, all kinds of degradation, and then burned at the stake in Oxford University. Of course, he's a graduate of Cambridge. The end result of Mary's attempts to return England to Catholicism were rather to convince the vast majority of Englishmen in a resolution and determination to never again succumb to such tyranny, superstition and intolerance as Catholicism. By trying to exterminate the Reformation, Bloody Mary only succeeded in entrenching a counterproductive counter-reformation. She left a ruined realm in her wake. She only had 5 years, but she did a lot of damage at that time. Bloody Mary ended her days in great agony and fever, mental derangements. She had 2 phantom pregnancies all the way through for months and months and months. I mean, there was no pregnancy, but she was absolutely convinced she was pregnant, and everyone had to indulge her superstitions. And the death of Bloody Mary on the 17th of November, 1558, was an occasion of great public rejoicing in England. During Mary's 5 short year reign, the country had been ruined. Elizabeth became the queen of a country ravaged by pestilence, because hygiene was shot. Sickened by the sight of countless grey-haired men of God, being burned at the stake, callously tortured to death for so-called heresy. England's credit was destroyed. Nobody wanted to lend money to England. They couldn't pay their debts. The currency was debased. There was virtually no silver, and the silver was virtually no gold, and the gold, all their coins were worthless. The people were oppressed. They were on the verge of revolution. Historians observed that the shouts of joy and the cheers at Elizabeth's coronation were more celebration of the death of Mary than of new queen, of whom the people at that time knew very little. But she was definitely King Henry's daughter. It was the 15th of January, 1559, when the Protestant Elizabeth Tudor was crowned Queen of England. And 1559 was a great turning point in history. 1559, the tyrant, King Charles, the very King Charles V, under whom Martin Luther had been compelled to give his "Here I Stand, I Can Do No Other" speech, that King Charles V died in agony. The Mary, who was ruling Netherlands, also died. She was also a hideous persecutor. The regent who was running Scotland, who was also a Mary, died. And there was another Mary in France, who was also a hideous persecutor of the church. She died, one of the Guises. And you saw in 1559 the return of Protestantism to England, and in 1560, the return of the Protestant faith to Scotland, and there was a tremendous victory in Netherlands and France, in Scotland and England. The Protestants were on the march, Catholicism was on retreat. So this was a major turning point in Reformation history. Elizabeth was just 25 years old when she became queen. Interesting, that's the date Elizabeth II became queen, also aged 25. There's quite a few similarities and a few contrasts between the two Elizabeths, but historians wrote there was no doubt who her father was. Commanding carriage, auburn hair, eloquence of speech, natural dignity proclaimed her King Henry's daughter. Other similarities were soon observed. High courage in moments of crisis. A fiery, imperious resolution when defied. An almost inexhaustible fund of physical energy. She could speak 6 languages, including German. She was well-read in Latin and Greek. As for her father and grandfather, restless vitality led her. And she was the most courted woman in Europe. Visitors to court described her as tall, beautiful, young, brilliant, hard-headed. In other words, stubborn. Red, gold, curly hair, pale face, shrewd blue eyes, long white hands. As the unmarried Queen of England, she became the main interest in diplomatic circles for marriages of alliance. Almost immediately, the English court was flooded with ambassadors and emissaries for half the kings and princes of Europe seeking to court her, bringing pictures of their princes and dauphins and what have you. And of course, everyone from Austria, France, Spain were all seeking allegiance by getting her to marry, which would then extend their influence. But she was a Protestant queen, first and foremost. Her faith was most important too. Queen Elizabeth ended the horror of the English Counter-Reformation. Under Bloody Mary, many Protestant clergy had been either executed or forced to flee the country. In fact, that wasn't a bad thing. Many of those English clergy who fled to Germany, to Worms, to the Netherlands, and especially to Zurich, where they came under the teaching of Heinrich Bullinger, the successor to Ulrich Zwingli, and to Geneva, where they came under influence of especially John Calvin and Bullinger, and also Bucer. And their is where the Geneva Bible was translated, the great English Bible, which until the King James Bible was the main Bible in the process. 1860, that was completed in Geneva under John Knox's counsel and guidance as well. So the English clergy, being exiled under Bloody Mary, came back with a far greater depth of doctrine and devotion from the Reformation giants on the continent. Elizabeth firmly established the Protestant faith as the national faith and ended the Catholic persecutions. It's notable that although she herself had been imprisoned in the Tower of London, threatened with execution, Elizabeth was not vindictive. She did not do any vengeance. She ended the religious persecutions. She did not allow for retribution or revenge. She steadfastly resisted all attempts to punish the Catholics, which there was a lot of people who wanted that done. They killed my relatives, my pastors, and she ended the cycle of violence. She insisted that unless the Catholics broke the laws of the realm, Catholics were entitled to equal protection under the law. Tremendous tolerance, very unique for that era. I'm talking about 1860s here. There was a rebirth of freedom and industry. Elizabeth encouraged English enterprise and commerce, and she established a consistent legal code. Her reign was noted for the English Renaissance, and it was an outpouring of poetry and drama led by William Shakespeare and Edmund Spenser and Christopher Marlowe. Their writings remain unsurpassed in English literary history, which is why 300 odd years later, 400 years now, we still are using Hamlet and Macbeth and so on in our schools, and Romeo and Juliet and other great works of Shakespeare, because it's unsurpassed. I mean, how do you improve on these things? It was during Elizabeth's reign that England began to expand trade overseas, and the merchant navy grew dramatically. And shipbuilding boomed under Elizabeth. And this is the Golden Hind, as you can see, the Golden Hind. And it's on this ship that Sir Walter, who was the one who first circumnavigated the world? Not Walter Raleigh, it's the other one.
Columbus.
Sorry?
Columbus.
No, Christopher Columbus, centuries before, and he's an Italian and Spanish. Sir Francis Drake. This is Sir Francis Drake's ship, rebuilt to specs recently to celebrate that. And it's on this little ship that Sir Francis Drake and the Golden Hind, this is the recreation of Golden Hind, circumnavigated the globe. Can you imagine? And on his way, he said, the Cape, the Table Mountain, was the fairest cape in all the world. He came right past our place. Well, Elizabeth had the fiery red hair and bold spirit of her father, King Henry VIII. She also possessed this fierce temper and determination to rule. The rule of Elizabeth I was marked by great achievements in arts, sciences, and by voyages of exploration to distant lands by unprecedented prosperity. Standard of living rose dramatically. Initially, to redeem her country, who was in terrible debt, she set in place a stringent economy with heavy taxation to reclaim the nation's credit, and she sold the port of Calais, which was still English at that stage on the other side of the channel, for 500,000 crowns, which went a long way to paying off their national debt, because that had been English for centuries, but let the French have it. Elizabeth juggled the diplomatic hot potatoes of marriage proposals from Philip of Spain and Archduke Charles of Austria and Henry of Anjou and many others without ever actually saying no. She was a diplomat enough to keep them guessing, keep them hoping, to maintain some good diplomatic ties while Britain built up its defences, built up its navy, built up its army, built up its treasury, because Britain was very weak militarily, economically at the beginning of her reign. And so she used her charm and diplomatic relations with these other countries to have them all hoping that they might have a marriage of alliance with England. But there was the constant threat of assassination. It's something like 60 different attempts and conspiracies to assassinate her in her lifetime. So throughout a 45-year reign, Elizabeth had to deal with constant treachery and intrigues, with all kinds of conspiracies and attempts to take her out, terminate with extreme prejudice, all that sort of thing, executive decisions, whatever they call them these days, which is why she invented, really, the world's first secret service. Jesuit revolutionaries and assassins were sent from Spain to reconvert England and sow the seeds of revolt and treason, and the Jesuits were at the root of most of the attempts to assassinate her. And they succeeded in assassinating many people. William, Prince William of Orange, for example, Netherlands, was assassinated by a Jesuit, and that's just part of the history. They did a lot of assassinations. Elizabeth showed an astounding ability to survive countless conspiracies and assassination attempts. Living in such perilous times with so many international intrigues to assassinate her and attempt to enforce the Catholic Inquisition back upon England, Elizabeth needed to establish an extensive intelligence system which was ably controlled by a brilliant spy master, Francis Walsingham. Some years ago, I went to the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and they attribute, and they've got a lot of very, very interesting things, all of the different histories of especially the Cold War, but it starts off with Francis Walsingham and Queen Elizabeth, the birth of modern espionage, and that they attribute to Walsingham as the father of espionage, counterintelligence, and all of that, the ultimate spy master, and it's Elizabeth who gave him that brief. And he was a dedicated Protestant, and his goal was to keep Elizabeth alive, and keep Catholicism from achieving, again, control over England, bring the Inquisition back. And he was spectacularly successful in that he kept her alive for 45 years, despite 60 conspiracies to assassinate her. Privately, Queen Elizabeth suffered the pain of betrayal, lots of betrayal, much sorrow, a lot of loneliness, but she dealt with treason and threats to her life as calmly as she regarded the many suitors who sought her hand in marriage. Without saying no, she kept herself single, realizing that her life was safer if she kept them guessing and kept them hoping, and her country was stronger and safer the longer she could keep this show playing around that she's considering these proposals. And there was no way she ever was going to consider marrying someone from Spain or France or any of these Catholic countries anyway. But she had a genius for surrounding herself with the best possible advisors and for taking their advice. Unlike the Elizabeth films that show her disregarding the advice of her advisors, she actually always let William Cecil, later Lord Burghley, as a chief minister, and she said to him, one of her requirements was, I want you to always feel free to criticize me and tell me what needs to be said. And she normally took his advice, which does not come through in the films. And he also stayed with her for 40 years. 40 years he was her chief minister, which again, you wouldn't get that impression from these fictional Hollywood versions. William Cecil's been described by historians as the perfect servant of a woman who preferred not to let her right hand know what her left hand was doing. She had to be very, very surreptitious to stay alive and to stay effective and to protect England. She came to the throne when England was so weak it couldn't defend itself if it had needed to. And so it was her intrigue that kept England alive strong, long enough that they could build up to be a significant military force. The threat posed by Mary, Queen of Scots, was probably the most serious. When Mary, Queen of Scots, fled from her defeat at Langstaden, 1568, Mary, Queen of Scots, was such an intriguer. She had her second husband murdered, and then she married the one who murdered him, and the Scots were wanting to put up with this, and she was full of so many intrigues and so many assassinations. She said that she feared the prayers of John Knox more than the army of 10,000, and at one point she had to flee and seek shelter and protection from her cousin Elizabeth, who she'd been plotting to overthrow regularly anyway, and was under effective house arrest at Fotheringay Castle as a result. During the 18 years of Mary's imprisonment, but really called imprisonment, she was under house arrest in Castle. She became the centre of innumerable plots and conspiracies to assassinate Elizabeth and usurp the throne. There's absolutely no question that she did. And Walsingham amassed a colossal library of her secret ink and secret messages that she sent backwards and forwards with Jesuit conspirators, all planning to assassinate or execute Queen Elizabeth and replace her on the throne. So she is obviously a complete and utter traitor. Mary Stuart imperiled Elizabeth and imperiled the Reformation and imperiled England. One assassin could bring down the government and bring back the Catholic Inquisition. I mean, it was that fragile. If they killed Elizabeth, Mary Stuart's next in line and the Inquisition's in her baggage. Mary Stuart represented Spain and the vast Catholic International and the guises of France, into whose family she was also married. In this map you can see the green represents the Protestants, the brown represents Catholicism, and the yellow represents areas that were Protestants and then were won back to Catholicism by the Counter Reformation. And that gives you a bit of a quick eyes view of about in 1560 what it was like in Europe in terms of the battles between Protestantism in the north and Catholicism in the south. In 1580, the Jesuits Edward Campion and Robert Persons infiltrated England to plan uprising. An army of Spanish and Italian volunteers bearing papal banners invaded Ireland. In 1583, a Catholic plot was uncovered that involved great English noblemen, all Catholic, along with Philip II of Spain, who's of course the widower of Bloody Mary and King of Spain, and Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots, that is, and a Spanish plan for invasion of England. Elizabeth expelled the Spanish ambassador, continued English support for the Dutch freedom fighters who were seeking to overthrow the oppression of Spain under William of Orange, for example. At that time, Holland was still a colony of Spain. Can you imagine? The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in France in 1572 permanently altered Protestant thinking. They had a marriage where it was meant to be a marriage between Protestant family and Catholic family, both heirs to the throne, and this is going to bring unity to the Protestant Catholics in France. And meanwhile, to the plot, when the Protestants gathered in Paris, they were massacred. Tens of thousands of Protestants were massacred all over France on the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. And here the Queen, Elizabeth, summoned the Spanish ambassadors, and when they came to the court to explain themselves, the entire court was dressed in mourning in black. And the Spanish ambassadors were treated with the contempt they deserved to be. Calvinists turned from previously accepting the divine rights of kings to questioning the entire institution of the monarchy, which laid serious foundations for constitutional monarchy. Parliament had to intervene. When Mary, Queen of Scots, was finally placed on trial at Fotheringay Castle, Elizabeth sought to stop the proceedings. This is her cousin, after all. Parliament intervened, insisted Mary Stuart must be tried for treason. When the court found Mary guilty of plotting the assassination of Elizabeth and of the overthrow of all religious freedom in England, Elizabeth refused to sign the death warrant. The way they make it out that Queen Elizabeth killed her cousin, not at all. Parliament insisted that the law be followed against Elizabeth's wishes, because Queen Elizabeth never wanted to see her cousin executed. And even though her cousin had been plotting her murder multiple times. Well, this was just a pretext for Philip launching the Armada. Mary Stuart was beheaded on the 12th of February, 1587. Mary's execution was seized upon by Philip II of Spain, who had been planning for years anyway, to build up the greatest armada the world had ever seen, demolishing whole forests to build his ships. And he called for the entire Catholic world to crusade against Protestant England, and the Pope echoed this call. So every Catholic was bound to fight. It was like a Catholic version of a fatwa being issued against Queen Elizabeth. English gold and English support was bolstering the anti-Catholic cause in Scotland and the Netherlands. And so Philip was going to go to the heart of the problem, the fountainhead of Protestant intrigue in Europe, because they were trying to have control over the Spanish colony of the Netherlands and, of course, over the French-controlled Scotland. And to do this, they had to get rid of England, bring England under Spain. With Philip having conquered Portugal and having expanded Spain's Atlantic power, he now ordered his admirals to assemble an armada which should crush the Protestants in England once for all. So by May 1588, Philip had prepared a fleet of 130 ships, 2,400 cannon, over 30,000 men. This was the greatest naval force the world had yet seen. It was called the Invincible Armada. Now, you should have named things invincible beforehand, but still. The plan was for the Armada to sail up the English Channel, pick up troops in Spanish Netherlands, under the Duke of Parma, escort his invasion barges across the Channel to conquer England. Queen Elizabeth ordered the entire nation to pray for God's intervention and protection against the invading Armada. There was a lot at stake. This is an interesting point. You see the line. The Pope drew a line through the map and said the Western Hemisphere belongs to Spain and the Eastern Hemisphere belongs to Portugal. And so that's why Portugal's got that section of South America that sticks out, that's Brazil, and Spain's got everything else. While Spain didn't have any colonies in Central or Southern Africa, they did have Morocco, but that's different. And they had some Spanish Morocco just over there, but the rest of it was all Portuguese. Had the Spanish Armada succeeded, today's world would be unrecognizable. Spain was the Catholic superpower. England led the Protestant cause. All of Europe feared Spain. Spain had overwhelmed all its adversaries, that even defeated the Turks at the Battle of Lepanto just a short time before. Had the Armada succeeded, the whole subsequent history of England and Scotland would have been dramatically changed. Dramatically. There would have been no Protestant North America, no Anglo-Saxon civilization. English wouldn't be the world's predominant language, it would be Spanish. Spain would be the unrivaled superpower, and Spanish would be the world's language. And we would probably be speaking Spanish if we were alive, but we probably wouldn't be, because our ancestors would probably be killed, just the way things worked with the Spanish Inquisition. So we'd probably not be here in any shape, and certainly not as Protestants, if the Spanish Armada had succeeded. Queen Elizabeth I then gave one of the greatest speeches ever made. An English army of almost 20,000 men assembled at Tilbury to oppose the anticipated 30,000 men in the Spanish Armada and the 15,000 Spanish troops that were coming under the brutal Duke of Parma to be ferried across the Channel barges. So they were going to be heavily outnumbered. So Queen Elizabeth addressed the soldiers in Tilbury with these words: "I am come amongst you, as you see, resolved in the midst and heat of the battle to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people, my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. And I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm, to which rather than any dishonor should grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general judge and reward of every one of you and of your virtues in the field." Very great speech. The Royal Navy had been under control of Sir John Hawkins since 1573, and he'd rebuilt and reorganized the Navy that had survived from the days of Henry VIII, but which had so deteriorated under Mary that it was not even seaworthy when Elizabeth came to power. The castles which had towered above the galleon decks had now been cut down. The keels were deepened, the designs concentrated in seaworthiness and speed, not just a bunch of castles built on a wooden float going around the water that were top-heavy. Most significantly of all, Hawkins had installed heavier long-range guns that could bring the Spanish fleet in range before they were within the Spanish fleet's range. Knowing that he could not outproduce the Spanish in terms of the size and number of the galleons, Hawkins was determined to batter the enemy from a distance with the superior range of his cannon. Normally you say, if the enemy's in range, you are too. But that wasn't true in their case, because they'd make sure they had the longer range cannons on their ships. Now the Armada carried 2,400 cannon, but these were only really suitable for close range salvos before grappling and boarding enemy vessels for hand-to-hand combat by the infantry who were being transported by ships. They weren't really a great sea people, they were more the ships were just to get them to land there and do the battles. And even when they came in range of another fleet, they'd have to line up on the side and fire their volleys at close range and then grapple and then board and then fight hand to hand. That was their battle plan. The English Navy said, no, we're going to have long range cannon on our ships, doesn't matter how hard that is, and we're going to batter them long before we can come within their range. So to oppose the Armada's 130 ships, Hawkins had 34 vessels. Heavily outnumbered, he had 6,000 men. His commanders were Lord Howard and Sir Francis Drake. It was Sir Francis Drake's famous raid on the Spanish Armada in port at Cadiz in 1587, which had delayed the sailing of the Armada by destroying a large quantity of their ships and their stores. They described this as the singeing of the King of Spain's beard. So they were ready to sail in 1587, but a preemptive raid made that harder. Well, the Spanish Armada filled the horizon. The Armada finally left Tagus on the 20th of May, which was afflicted by severe storms. Obviously, it's good to have God on your side when you're fighting these things, so prayer was the first battle. Two of the 1,000-ton ships lost their masts. They had to put into refit at Karuna. It could not sail until the 12th of July. And you can see all the way along the southern part of England, there were battles, endless battles all the way along, to basically wear them down by attrition, and every time, before you could come within range, withdraw. An intelligence report, 21st of July, from Howard to Walsingham, reported sighting 120 sail vessels, including galleys and many ships of great burden, transport ships, which were transporting everything from troops to stores and horses. Beacons were lit all across England to alert the population to the danger. Maybe you've seen an old 1930s film called Fire of England. It's one on the coming of the Armada. The beacons being lit one after the other. When the next beacon can see that, then they lighten them. Very quickly, it could be seen in London to alert the people. Church bells rang. Special services were held to pray for God's protection. And Howard's fleet awaited the Armada from Plymouth, and then they battered them from a distance, withdrawing continually the closer they got to the channel. But they had to get to the channel because most invasion troops were up here on Gravelines, Dunkirk, and they were going to cross over from there. So they needed to be reduced, to use the military term, before getting to the key position. The English engaged the Armada in a four-hour battle, pounding away with their long-range guns, but staying out of range of Armada's cannon. There's a further engagement on the 23rd of July, then off the Isle of Wight on the 25th of July. The guns of the English ships raked the decks of the galleons, killing many of the crews and soldiers, what is called reducing the enemy. By the 28th of July, the Spanish Armada anchored in the English Channel near Calais. That's at the narrowest point. As the English Navy lay upwind from the Spanish, they determined to set adrift eight fireships filled with explosives to drift into overcrowded Spanish fleet at anchor. Very hard to get ships that are all compressed and on anchor to lift anchors in time and to disengage in sail ships without crashing into one another. As the Spanish crews awake to see flaming ships drifting towards these anchored armada, they panicked. Spanish captains cut their cables, that now means you don't have anchors for the rest of your journey. Made for open sea, collisions followed. The surviving ships of the Armada headed eastwards to Gravelines. Gravelines is in Belgium, expecting to link up with Palmer's troops and barges, ready to be escorted for the invasion of England. But the tides and the winds were against them. They found no sign of Palmer's troops in Dunkirk Harbour. At this point, the Royal Navy caught up with the Spaniards, and a long and desperate battle raged for 8 hours. Howard's men sank or damaged many Spanish ships, drove others onto the banks. The English report at this point they'd completed, exhausted the ammunition, otherwise scarcely a Spanish ship would have escaped. It's a limit to how much ammunition and powder you can carry. The Armada was devastated, but that wasn't the end. The remnants of the defeat of Armada now chose to travel northward, seeking to sail around the north of Scotland in order to reach Spain by coming around Scotland and Ireland. Bad move, especially when you've cut your anchors. They faced mountainous seas, racing winds and tides. Westerly winds drove two galleons to wreck on the coast of Norway. Ships that had been shattered by the English cannons were now struck by storms. Another 17 ships were wrecked along the coast of Britain. Most of the once mighty armada were lost before the battered survivors finally reached the Spanish ports in October. God blew and they were scattered. Incredibly, the English had lost not a single ship in battle, aside from the eight fireships they sent in. Scarcely 100 men on the Royal Navy side had died in the ferocious engagements against the Spanish Armada. Though limited in supplies, limited in ships, the tactics of Hawkins and his admirals, especially Howard and Drake, had been crowned with success. A medal was struck to commemorate the victory, bearing the inscription, "God blew and they were scattered." It was, first and foremost, an answer to prayer. We can't command the winds and the waves. Churches throughout England were holding extraordinary prayer meetings. Devastating storms wrecked the Spanish plans in a way that the Navy could not have. The Duke of Parma's invasion barges from Holland were prevented from linking up with Armada by Dutch action. The Dutch freedom fighters were effective at sabotage on the other side of the channel. And the English tactic of setting fireships amongst the huge Spanish galleons caused confusion. and courageous action by the English seamen and continuing storms decimated and broke up this great Spanish armada, the Invincible Armada. Most of what was left of Philip's fleet was devastated by more storms off the coast of Scotland and Ireland, and only a miserable remnant of the once proud armada limped back into the ports of Spain. 51 Spanish ships, 20,000 men had been lost. The greatest superpower of the time had suffered a crippling, humiliating blow. The defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 marked a great watershed in history. It signaled the decline of Catholic Spain and Portugal and the rise of Protestant England and Holland. And Spain and Portugal never recovered. It was a victory for the Protestant Reformation. Before 1588, the world powers were Spain and Portugal. These Roman Catholic empires dominated the seas and the overseas possessions of Europe, and only after the English defeated the Spanish Armada did the possibility arise of Protestant missions crossing the seas. Before this time, for example, John Calvinist of Geneva had sent out an entire missionary team to Brazil, who were all killed by the Spanish Inquisition when they got to Brazil. They were found out very easily. And it just was not possible to do missions overseas while the Catholics dominated the seas and the overseas positions. As the Dutch and British grew in military and naval strength, they were able to challenge the Catholic dominations of the seas and new continents. And so foreign missions now became a distinct possibility after 1588. Had the Spanish Armada not been defeated, the Protestant faith would have been extinguished in England and Holland. And the whole future of North America would have been very different, with Catholicism dominating instead of the Protestant pilgrims. And the victory of Protestant England and Protestant Netherlands against Catholic Spain was absolutely essential for the founding of the United States of America and of the Republic of South Africa. Just look at the time. By the grace of God, the destruction of the Spanish Armada in 1588 saved the Protestant Reformation in England from Spanish invasion, oppression, and the Inquisition. So defeating Spain was probably one of the greatest achievements of Queen Elizabeth. The policy of Elizabeth's government continued to be to distract the enemy in every quarter of the world. This was accomplished by subsidizing the Protestant resistance fighters in the Netherlands and the Huguenots in France, and by attacking the forces and allies of Spain throughout the world by her sea dogs, the Rileys and Sir Francis Drake's out there. And the expeditions to Cadiz and to the Azores and the Caribbean, many other campaigns were accomplished with very slender resources, normally by what they called privateers. At that time, the total revenues of the crown barely exceeded £300,000 a year in total. The cost of defeating the Armada was calculated to amount to £160,000, more than half of their total revenue. But an expeditionary force to the Netherlands to help the Dutch in their fight for freedom from the Spanish cost another £126,000 just in 1 year. So you can see just fighting Spain was most of their national treasury expenses. Therefore, raiding Spanish ships not only denied the enemy resources that could have been used to threaten the Protestant causes of Europe and even the independence of England, but they needed the Spanish gold they were catching from those ships traveling from the Caribbean in order to finance the defense of the realm and assistance to Huguenots in France and assistance to the Dutch and other freedom fighters in the low countries of Belgium and the Netherlands. So it's a magnificent heritage. Under Queen Elizabeth, England flourished spiritually, militarily, and economically. The Elizabethan years saw some of the greatest soldiers, explorers, scientists, philosophers, and poets ever produced. Under Elizabeth, Parliament flourished, and it certainly had not under Edward, under Henry, or under Mary. But under Elizabeth, Parliament in England flourished, and the Protestant Reformation became entrenched in the Church of England and through the Puritan movement. The Puritans were Calvinists who wanted to go back to the doctrines of the Reformation, but they wanted devotion, strong, strong devotion. So it was head and heart, a very powerful combination. Elizabeth was the last of the Tudor monarchs. For over 100 years, the Tudors had guided the country through tumultuous times and changes. With the death of Queen Elizabeth on 24th of March 1603, the Tudor dynasty ended because she never married, never had children. The crown now passed to an alien Scottish line, the Stuarts. The cooperation between the crown and parliament that the Tudors had nourished would now come to a very fretful close. This, by the way, is the tomb of Elizabeth, which is also Westminster Abbey, where the funeral of the late Queen Elizabeth II was just held. The new kings, James I, James II, Charles I, Charles II, and James II, they were the Stuarts. They would repeatedly clash with the Protestant majority of the country and with their parliamentary representatives. This would lead to civil war in the 1640s and the execution of Charles I and the triumph of the Protestant parliament over Catholic monarchists. All those foundations of the Protestant cause were laid in the time of Queen Elizabeth. Now, I've drawn this lecture from History of the English-Speaking People, the Great Christian Revolution, which is the finest book on that time, the 1500s and 1600s, especially of the English Civil War. Otto Scott's Great Christian Revolution is a phenomenally interesting book. And also the book Elizabeth I and the Spanish Armadas. Those are my main sources for today's presentation. We will be having this article and the audio video of this presentation uploaded in frontlinemissionsa.org as soon as possible, probably tomorrow. So, does anyone have any questions, comments on Elizabeth? Yes.
Did she die naturally or was she killed? Or
well, kind of naturally. She died of poisoning, but it was self-inflicted. The cosmetics used had a lot of mercury in it. And so she basically died of mercury poisoning. It was believed that you had to be very white. It was part of the passion. And so the paste they used on their faces to make themselves even whiter. Very bad for skin, but I believe there's not a skin like this today that's not good for you either. But this was really bad. This was mercury poisoning. And so in the skin lightener she used, she basically caused such damage that she lost all her hair. Her beautiful old golden red hair. And so she wore wigs for most of the rest of her life because her hair had fallen out. And she lost everything, from eyebrows and whatever, from this mercury poisoning. She ended up, and then more and more makeup, but the makeup contributed to death. The makeup was proven later to be so deadly poison. So it's a case of, you know, some people die from medical practices that later they realized weren't a good idea at the time. Here's a case of cosmetics that literally were deadly to your health. So she poisoned herself thanks to the cosmetic traditions or customs of that time. That's the verdict of history now. Mercury poisoning.
Thank you, Dr. Hammond, for the lovely talk. Yeah, I just wanted to ask about just how the monarchy works. So she didn't have a king by her side. That was because that youngster who was 15 got poisoned.
That was her brother, who was probably assassinated by Jesus. Yes.
So for there to have been a king, why didn't she have a king by her side?
Okay, well, she could have chosen to marry, but her sister Mary, as in Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, people get confused, a lot of Marys out there. Just like you get in the Bible, you get quite a few Herods and you get quite a few Johns, so you've got to separate them and understand there's multiple. But, and there's a lot of Marys in the Reformation period and they're all bad, basically, sadly. So Mary was the first Queen of England. Up till then, there'd never been a queen ruling in her own right. There'd always been the king who would marry and make a queen. But she'd be the queen consort. She would not be the sovereign queen. She'd be the queen, but under the king. But Mary was the first queen of England, but she is such a bad one that if she was the only queen, they would probably have decided we're never going to have another queen again. But Elizabeth was such a successful queen that it meant it was possible in future. Up till then, it had always been felt, no matter what, it's got to be a male heir. It couldn't be a female heir. But Henry put Mary and then Elizabeth in line for the throne, probably thinking that they wouldn't get to it because he hoped Edward would live a long life. The fact that Edward only lived to 15 before dying, so only reigned from age 9 to 15, which is very sad because Edward was a good, he was like a Josiah type of king. He really wanted Christ to be honored and the Bible to be read, the authorized Book of Common Prayer, and a whole lot of good things. So her brother Edward dying was tragic. Her sister Mary being queen was catastrophic, disastrous. But because it was such a short reign, it actually was so counterproductive for the Catholic cause, it served the cause of the Reformation that people were ready for Elizabeth giving a more enlightened reign. But she could have been a bad queen if she decided to go in with revenge and decide to counter persecute the Catholics for what they've done. And then to have just made the cycle of hatred and revenge worse and worse. So the fact she was so conciliatory and so gracious, and that she didn't allow any revenge against the Catholics in England, they started to see, well, she's their queen too, and it wasn't just a Catholic versus Protestant, but now she was the queen of all and she's protecting all. So that gave hope for the future. And Britain became overwhelmingly Protestant as a result. But she could have married, but let's face it, if she had married unwisely, say she had married a Catholic from France or Spain, well, that would have been catastrophic for England. You can imagine why she was very, very, very cautious to marry. Marriage had literally killed her mother and her stepmother. No wonder she is cautious about marriage, because she had grown up, most of her life had been fear for her life. In fact, probably all of her life she is afraid either to be executed under Mary or that she would be assassinated by a Jesuit. So you can understand why she is cautious. And she probably realized that if she got married, she would now lose full control and maybe she'd lose her life. Just bearing in mind that her father had executed a couple of his queens, what on earth was she to think? What was she to do? And so she laid the foundation that you can have a queen on her own without a king. Because when Queen Mary was married, then her husband became king, co-equal with her in England, which is interesting. But he wasn't just known as the Prince of, he was King Philip. And that's, imagine how disastrous that would have been. But Elizabeth said there will be one mistress and no master in England, quite simply.
You know, I've got vague memories about this period, but she had a lover, Lord Leicester, someone. Can't remember the name now, but
yes.
that sort of relationship went on, and then they kind of fell, and I can't remember whether this guy was Catholic or whatever, but I seem to remember that he was executed.
That's correct.
And she had him executed because he was plotting it. It was said that he was plotting against her.
Yes, there are a few of those cases. So, she had boyfriends, plural. There's no evidence that she ever went all the way into full sexual relations, but she certainly had, she had boyfriends, she liked to be courted, she liked to taunt, tease, play with the men's emotions somewhat, and but that's another place. And when this chap got too big for his boots, she had one of them executed. Now, normally, these people who were her lovers in a general sense, but we don't know how far it went. But she certainly was very cautious because she knew her life was at stake. She had the one she shared executed, because there were a couple of them. Could that have been Wessex, the Duke of Wessex?
Mm-hmm.
He got so arrogant, he rushed in to her bedroom at one point, found her without her wig and without her makeup and all the rest, and she was so horrified, and he went and he spoke ill of how he had found her. And for that indiscretion and lack of loyalty and so on, she had him executed. She had him arrested for treason and had him executed. So I think there was a reason for it. He got arrogant. And there was also talk that he might have been trying to usurp more power than he had been given. But she could be super generous to her favorites, very generous. And what's also intriguing, she surrounded herself with men doing all the work. It's intriguing, like, for example, Margaret Thatcher. When Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, Queen Elizabeth said, watch, she won't have one single woman in her cabinet. In fact, Margaret Thatcher had no woman in her cabinet. And when she challenged her about that, she said, women are too emotional, can't have them in the cabinet. And Queen Elizabeth apparently said to Margaret Thatcher, well, you won't have this problem with me. she could be objective and keep emotions in check. But intriguing, when you get a woman ruler, frequently she will surround herself only with men, which is what Elizabeth did. She surrounded herself with men, she played with emotions, she liked them flattering her, but if they got too big for the boots, as in the case of Wessex, he faced the chopping block. Which you can sort of see she was her father's daughter. I mean, that's what Henry would have done. And did too. An intriguing person. This is why when people come out and say that our present Queen Elizabeth, in our past, was England's greatest queen, they can't say that. They can say she's the longest reigning, but you cannot put a constitutional monarch who's been effectively a figurehead doing an important work in bringing unity to people. You can't compare that with Queen Elizabeth or Queen Victoria with what they achieved, let alone King Alfred the Great. So I think the people who talk like this don't know the history. Your greatness isn't in how long you lived or how long you reigned. It's what you did. And in that sense, I'd say Queen Elizabeth I is without doubt Britain's greatest queen and possibly Britain's greatest monarch of all time. That's my opinion. Yes?
How long did the father reign?
Long enough to be married 6 times. let's see. He came to power about 1508, 1509. He reigns about 1536. So he was in power for 28 odd years. About 28 years.
Because I was just thinking, like, 45 years is really good. Like, in that time...
Phenomenal.
Like, I don't see that Queen Elizabeth II ended the world, but there were, like, assassination attempts on her life the whole time.
Not the whole time.
And so, like, the fact that Queen Elizabeth I reigned for 45 years is impressive, and...
Life expectancy was about 28, 29.
Yeah. Really impressive.
Yeah. By the way, Queen Elizabeth did once face a definite assassination attempt. A man during the Trooping of the Colour ran out and fired 5 shots to her from very close range, closer than you are to me right now. And she just brought her horse under control, didn't look behind her, carried on while police and bystanders piled on this man, disarmed him and so on. She didn't look back, she continued with the Trooping of the Colour. Of course her horse was spooked, but she controlled her horse. I mean, imagine having 9mm fired at close range, and she could bring her horse under control, and she didn't even look over her shoulder to see what happened. Just left it to everyone else and carried on. So that's one time another the present Queen Elizabeth faced an apparent assassination attempt and responded very coolly. Also, interestingly, her daughter, Princess Anne, the Princess Royal, faced a kidnapping attempt. A kidnapper blocked her car, shot her driver and bodyguard, and pointed the gun to her in the back seat and told her to get out, and she said, not bloody likely. And she fought him and got away and got him arrested, and she just wouldn't cooperate. So Princess Anne's quite a character as well, a fighting spirit. There's got to be something of this fighting spirit going back in there. Intriguing. But anyway, you can see why I think that Queen Elizabeth I should be remembered at this time to give some context as to what British monarchs have done. Yes?
So I was there about 200 years between Queen Elizabeth I and Queen Elizabeth II. It was quite a long time.
That is quite... Well, in fact, it's more like... It's almost 400 years now. Queen Elizabeth I's reign ended in 1603. So it was... About 350 years before Queen Elizabeth II came to power. Just 350 years, yeah. So, intriguing. You had mostly kings. Because generally speaking, by the British tradition has been male heirs take precedence. And just recently they changed the order of succession that whoever's the oldest, whether it be daughter or son, is next in line. So, but that's just come about very recently. But up till now it's been, and the reason for that is, kings were expected to go to battle. You're meant to lead your nation in battle, and the kings were expected to go into the field, and they had to be exceptional horsemen, swordsmen, and all the rest. It was, you couldn't be a king if you couldn't fight well, and that was why you normally needed a man. But King Alfred the Great fought 54 battles in his lifetime against Vikings, and won, which is super impressive.
So, when you decide on the name, and this is what Victoria, etc., is it something that's following a pattern that's already written down?
It is. There's traditions, which makes me wonder why on earth a queen with such an illustrious name as Elizabeth, and by the way, her mother was also Elizabeth, so who we call Queen Mother. Elizabeth's a great name, but why would she name her son Charles? Considering the two previous Charles were catastrophic disasters. And Charles I led to the first experience in Britain being a republic. That's how bad he was. Why would you want Charles to be a name for a future king? But the king or queen can choose any name they want when they're crowned. Just like, you know, when the Pope becomes Pope, he can choose some arbitrary name that doesn't have to be. And he normally chooses a historic one. What's the correct name of this present Pope Francis? It's not his real name, is it? He's got some very Spanish type of name. Anyway, now, for example, King Edward the VII, that would have been Queen Victoria's son. His first name was Albert, but he chose not to be crowned the name of his father, who was beloved of his mother, because he despised his father, because they were so evangelical and had such a work ethic, and he was a lazy, drunkard, playboy layabout, and he chose to take another name, Edward, instead of Albert, because he didn't want to have his father's name, because his father represented everything he stood against. And Edward VII was a reprehensible type of king, and that's why he chose that name. He didn't want his father's name. And there are some who, if I'm not mistaken, King George VI was also not christened George. His first name, I think, was also Albert. I'm not sure why he didn't choose to take the name Albert either, which is so beloved of Queen Victoria, of course. So you do have a say. The fact that people wondered what name Charles would take, and they were surprised that he took the name Charles, which most monarchs choose another name than their given name. It's just interesting. Yes?
I have a question regarding the Jesuits. Is there still a threat today of Catholic Jesuits, like assassins? Is there still a threat?
It could be. It's possible. So, if you read Reverend Bill Batten's book going through, he will tell you in there of when he was doing Bible smuggling into Spain in 1950s. The Jesuits were still involved in intrigues and assassinations, and they even sent spies to Bible report back, so that when he was in a remote town in England giving a report back on mission to Spain, the military attaché from the Spanish embassy in London travelled all the way up there to sit the back and take details about what he was giving reports on, and raided the churches and did more persecution back in Spain on the basis of it. So the Jesuits were so involved that they were still assassinating people as late as the 1950s and early 60s in South America and Spain and so on. Officially, they stopped doing assassinations at Vatican II in 1964. But the Jesuits are still enforced. The Jesuits are the Society of Jesus. They're basically the shock troops and the secret service of the papacy. The present Pope, Francis, is the first Jesuit Pope in history. So that's intriguing. And the Jesuits are basically the KGB, the Secret Service. They do the dirty tricks of the papacy. And historically, they try to revise the image since Vatican II. So if they are involved in assassination and so on, they probably make it not look like an assassination. But I don't know what the policy is right now. They've gone into a charm offensive, as in the case of Francis. But it never was before, because the Jesuits have to swear unquestioning obedience to the Pope. and I've got a profusa jacket. So I think that's a bad sign. And this one is a Marxist. I used to have a joke, is the Pope Catholic? The person asked an obvious question, said, is the Pope Catholic? And the answer was obviously, well, yes. But you can't say that anymore because this Pope is not Catholic. This Pope is a Marxist. He is a liberation theologian. He does not hold traditional views. You can't call him Catholic in terms of his doctrine. He doesn't even believe you have to be Catholic to go to heaven. He doesn't believe you have to be Christian to go to heaven. He takes the whole critical race theory, LGBTQ. I mean, the man is so un-Catholic that the previous Pope, Benedict, would not have qualified this man as a Catholic. He condemned people of those views. So right now, Francis, very, very, very dangerous individual, even though he's got a nice image. But Jesuits specialize in deceit. So, yes, so in the lifetime of Bill Baffin, he saw and knew of cases of Jesuit assassinations. They were infiltrating Bible colleges in Canada and America. They were getting involved in relationships with people who were important Protestants in order to get scandals. They were literally doing honeypots, treating sort of what you'd expect from sparrows in the old KGB. So the KGB would, the Jesuits would literally be involved in enticing people into scandals and using it to destroy Protestants' reputations and things like this. And not just character assassinations, literal physical murdering assassinations, poisonings, stabbing, shootings, things like that. There's a couple of books out, The Secret History of the Jesuits. It's quite shocking. There we go. That's another classic book. So it's just beyond a belief. You can't make this stuff up. It's more incredible than any fiction could ever be, what the Jesuits have been up to, and they've been doing it for years. And it's an incredible thing that otherwise pretty lovely film, The Mission, makes out that the Jesuits were the ones who were helping these poor people being targeted by the Catholic Church, and the Jesuits were the heroes in the film The Mission, which is a bit of an inversion. I wonder if the story wasn't the other way around, because they would be more likely the ones on the other side. But they had the Jesuits fighting for the common Indian people while the papists from Portugal came and enslaved them, which is highly skeptical, even though it's based on a generally true story. But I think the fact they put the Jesuits in the role of being the heroes there, I thought that's really quite clear. That's a propaganda story.
Paul and I are much troubled that some of the service in Westminster Abbey, and I must say I was actually quite shocked when some of those scriptures were read, like, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to me but by the Father. I mean, there is a more offensive scripture, really,
yes,
in terms of what the world might think about.
Yes.
There were quite a few things like that. So, I mean, I don't personally know enough about Elizabeth II to know where she stood on these things, but is it true that she was the one who organized what her funeral would be and what scriptures?
She approved, she chose the hymns. She chose the hymns, Love Divine, Will Love's Excelling, and The Lord Is My Shepherd, because those were hymns sung at her wedding in the same tribute. She chose the scriptures, and by the way, many of the scriptures that had to be read are part of the Anglican prayer book order of a funeral service.
Wow.
Now, but because it was, and she's the head of the Church of England, or supreme governor of it, and so, but because the state funeral, they didn't use all of the order of service, which is a pity, but all the good things were, they're there in the prayer book. It's not like the dean had a choice.
Okay.
And the sermon was weak. That's the weakest part of the whole service, by Welby, who gave a bit of a universalist hope. Justin Welby, where he basically said, we can all share in the hope of eternal life that the Queen had, which is not true. Unless he added, if we share her faith, because what he needs to say is, God now commands all men everywhere to repent. That's what Paul said. Or what Peter said, that you must repent of your sins and be baptized, every one of you, Or what the Lord Jesus said, unless you're born again, you cannot see the kingdom of heaven. He should have put that in, but Justin Welby, we know what he is, he's a universalist, he put out a universalist. So. But the great hymns and the great scriptures in the service are part of the Book of Common Prayer, which has been set up for the order service in 1662. So what you saw is tradition. And this is what's great about this kind of tradition, is you've got traditions going back centuries, before being woke, before politically correct. And the Queen also had a hand in Operation London Bridge, and she chose the hymns and the scriptures for her own funeral, which is impressive. Of course, the people reading them, I don't think Liz Truss should have been reading John 14, although it's a great passage. I would like someone to read it who understands it. And as for this Secretary General of Commonwealth reading 1 Corinthians 15, great passage, but the person reading it did not comprehend what they were reading. It was evident. So there's good and there's bad, but this is the good thing about having an order of service and tradition, because this could be the only exposure most of the people of the world ever got of a traditional Christian service.
No, but you know what I'm asking is, who was she second? And the second one is, who is Charles? Because I don't hear much good about that guy.
No.
Was she, I mean, is it possible that Elizabeth was actually a believer?
Yes. So, I see the great comfort of where the master has already put out a message, I think within the first week of Queen Elizabeth dying, of is the Queen in heaven, and he puts in what she said, and he said, if she believes that, then she's a believer, and so on. And he goes on to how the gospel applies to you. But the Queen certainly said in her speeches enough scripture to show that she understood the gospel, and that Jesus Christ is her Lord and Savior, and that his Sermon on the Mount and his example provides a framework for her life and carrying out her duties and the hopes she has. And all the way along, her Christmas messages have been consistently Christian. So whether she's a traditional believer or born-again believer, there's a strong indication she is a born-again believer. That doesn't mean her discernment in all things is right. But, for example, not that Billy Graham's my favorite evangelist out there, but she developed a lifelong relationship with him. He came out to England in the 1950s. She asked him to come to Buckingham Palace. She had times of prayer with him. She very much supported his message. And I think Billy Graham's got a very weak message, but he did preach how to be born again. He was a better evangelist in the 50s than he became later. But still, the Queen seems to have been someone consistently Christian in her outer testimony. And in a politically correct interfaith country, that's quite remarkable, and she didn't seem to ever budge from that. And the fact that this service has got to have made a lot of people squirm, because filled in that place was, I mean, you had everyone from Biden in the 14th row, sort of behind, because it's a monarchist service. And so the monarchy comes first, and then the heads of state of the Commonwealth, and so President America's behind Trinidad and Tobago back there. Yes, I mean, I'm surprised they didn't take him to the servants' entrance and send him into the kitchen to do the dishes, because he didn't rate very high in the royalist scheme of things. And and Biden didn't even arrive in time, correct. So, shame. There's a lot to be said for tradition, you know, because rotten as the British government and country is, by sticking to tradition and order of service, they were compelled to be confronted with timeless truths of the scripture, the great hymns of the faith, in a church building that was built 1,000 years ago and has been a cathedral for over 700 years. They're just surrounded by history, and the order of service, no matter what they did, you had more heads of state than ever before in history in one place, and they were compelled to hear Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to Father but by me. And other great scriptures. I mean, it's powerful. So, praise God for it, and the word of God will not return void. Of those 4 billion people who listened, who knows how many a seed could be planted. And one can only hope and pray. It's a crossroads. Britain has a choice at this point. Are they going to continue in this multicultural, interfaith, politically correct, woke direction? Are they wanting to go on the broad road? Or are they going to return to the faith their fathers? It's a wonderful opportunity they've been given. In fact, as some people have noted, through her funeral, the Queen may have reached more people with some essential gospel truth than Billy Graham has in his whole life or something. It's an amazing thing that anyone who's paying attention, there was some powerful, significant scripture and principles and hymns there that 4 billion people are watching. Isn't that incredible? He has ears to hear. So, any other comments, questions? Well, let me ask you a question. In what ways can you see similarities between Queen Elizabeth I and Queen Elizabeth II? Neither at birth was expected to become queen. Both of them had, well, Queen Elizabeth I had a very, very traumatic upbringing, whereas Queen Elizabeth II had a very protective, loving, and secure upbringing. But neither of them expected to be queen. Nobody would have expected the things to have ordered so that suddenly, you know, Edward VIII abdicates for an American divorcee. I mean, how bad is that? Not sure which is the worst, but probably the American part. And it seems every time an American gets involved in the royal family, it goes off badly. Very badly, sad. So you've got suddenly King Edward VIII has abdicated, and her dad, who was just a prince, suddenly becomes king, and suddenly they push him to the top job. And that must have been quite a shock. But Queen Elizabeth I, nobody expected her to become queen either. And you can see how they went through times of tremendous upheaval, and they came to crowns in crisis. And the monarchy was very debased because of what Henry VIII had done, what Mary had done back in the 16th century. But confidence in the monarchy was at a pretty low ebb also when Queen Elizabeth came to the throne. Not only was the British Empire bankrupt and shocked by Edward abandoning his duty. Notice how Queen Elizabeth II epitomized duty. Duty above all things. Why? Her family was in turmoil, and her dad had died early because of the strain of the office, because her uncle didn't do his duty. He put his heart and his emotions and his relationship above his duty. And as a result, people's respect for the monarchy was quite shattered, and she had to rebuild confidence in it. And she went the duty direction. Well, her children haven't, but she did. And you can see other things. What was the biggest crisis in the life of Queen Elizabeth I?
Her brother died.
That's early on, yes, but thinking about her reign now. Another woman. Mary, Queen of Scots, posed the biggest single threat to her monarchy and life. Most of the plots to kill her all came around that. The real threat to her throne was not Philip as much as Mary, Queen of Scots. Closest relative, cousin, next in line for throne. What's the biggest crisis in Queen Elizabeth II's reign? Remember 25 years ago, Princess Diana's death? The Queen was very gracious her whole life, but maybe the only time she ever evidenced, I'm talking about Queen Elizabeth II, only time she ever evidenced anything resembling spitefulness was probably taking the Her Royal Highness titles away from Diana, and which was strange, because she's always been a gracious person. But Diana broke the law, their law. She went outside the family, she went to TV, she went to the media, she published, she leaked information to book. She put the royal family in a bad light by taking the marriage problems that she had with Charles and make it public knowledge. And the Queen instructed Charles to divorce her. And the royal, she's duty personified. Diana broke the rules, she was not loyal, and she is out. And she even stripped her of the titles. Very unusual. And as a result, the biggest crisis in Queen Elizabeth II's reign is when Princess Diana died and she didn't make any comment. No comment, didn't bring the flag to half-mast, didn't return to London, stayed up in Balmoral and so on. And all the newspapers in England went berserk, Prime Minister and everyone, calling for the abolition of the monarchy. Because the Queen wasn't showing the same grief over the death of Diana that the people were going. People went mad over Princess Diana's death. I don't know how many people remember. I remember very clearly, 25 years ago. The biggest threat to her life and her reign and ministry came from Princess Diana. She never faced more opposition to her reign, more hostility than over that. So interesting how another woman became the biggest threat to Queen Elizabeth I and to Queen Elizabeth II. If you look, there's quite a few interesting similarities how they operate, but there's contrasts. One contrast is Elizabeth I decided never to marry. Elizabeth II married, and she married for love, and she seems to have had a very stable and healthy relationship, despite Prince Philip, I'm sure, being a difficult person. He was a tough person, but the person that Elizabeth I was interested in was not acceptable to the royal crowds. And he was someone whose family was disgraced by quite a lot of his relatives had been executed for treason, things like that. And so he wasn't royal material. And Princess Elizabeth was told that Prince Philip was not suitable either. His family had been ousted from the throne in Greece. They were in exile. He came from a Danish royal family, but they also had the throne of Greece. And he didn't even have an address. There was no address that he could put down when he came to England, because family had lost their throne, lost their place. So Prince Philip came, and he was not considered suitable material for him. But Queen Elizabeth II chose to marry who she wanted to marry against the wishes of the rest of the family, interestingly. So, I mean, there are some similarities, there are contrasts. But to compare the two, there's no doubt in my mind Queen Elizabeth I was super successful and influenced world history dramatically. Queen Elizabeth II had a difficult task of presiding over the collapse of the British Empire and the collapse of British morals, although none of that was her fault, because she did not make those policies. It would have been nice to see her make a stand saying, no, I will not sign this legislation. I would have liked that. Nevertheless, I know that she was schooled to do her duty, and I would have preferred her to have more of a reformist spirit of saying, I will never sign this legislation. And there's been a lot of bad legislation. Just think of the legalization of abortion in Britain. But nevertheless, we can only respect Queen Elizabeth II for work ethic and diligence for duty, even though I'm sorry that she didn't take the stand of a reformer and fight. But it probably wasn't in her nature, and she served her job more to bring unity to the people. So nevertheless, having said all that, just by putting in the things that she put in for the final funeral, she ensured that a lot of the people around the world have heard elements of the gospel that I'm sure most would not have heard any other way. So, can be grateful for that. Any other comments or observations? Let me draw your attention to some of the upcoming events. Of course, 31st of October is always Reformation Day. We will have a Reformation Sunday service here. But on Monday we'll do a guided tour of the Huguenot Monument and Museum, which has been completely revamped and renovated. And then a service at 12 noon. 12 noon on Monday, the 31st, so that's a good opportunity to be out there. Until then, we've got, as always, the Reformation Art and Essay Competition for home educators. And the Saturday before the Reformation Day, we've got the Reformation Fair. Please support whether you've got tables, arts, crafts, food that you want to sell, or just to come to support. And after that, there'll be the variety concert here in the upper room. Musical items in particular, poetry, all sorts of things are welcome for the variety concert. On the 6th of November, first Sunday in November, we have Remembrance Sunday, remembering the people who have died in the wars, particularly Rhodesians, and that's at Bishop Methodist Church at 12:30 for one. And advance notice to recommend people who have not yet gone through the Biblical Worldview Summit and the Great Commission course coming up January next year. So, any other things that should be announced or items for prayer? Any other questions? The life chain, quite right. I should have brought that up. Not this Sunday, but next Sunday, the 2nd of October, life chain from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock at Breaking Cross Street. Yes, thank you. I should have mentioned it. I've got notes of tonight's presentation. I'll put on the table here on Queen Elizabeth V. I think it's a good time to remind people of history. The amounts of things I hear folks saying on the media, I've paid quite a lot of attention to what's gone on, because my father was a real royalist. Interesting how my father, despite fighting all 6 years of the Second World War in the Royal Artillery, North Africa, battled El Alamein, none of that was important. The most important event of his life was catering for the royal family at Victoria Falls Hotel in 1947 during the royal visit. That's the kind of royalist he was. He might have been a Rhodesian, fully supported our independence from Great Britain, but it was still God Save the Queen, you know. And extraordinary that to him, the highlight of his life was catering for the royal family at Victoria Falls in 1947. And there were so many other things he did in his life, but that just shows you the heart of a royalist. So I've inherited a bit of that, much as I am thoroughly South African Rhodesian, that still feels some kind of affinity for the royal family, even though the individuals may be very disappointing in many cases. But the institution itself represents tradition and Christian nationalism, which is resistance to the globalist, new world order, secularized, multicultural, interfaith, one world government thing. And for that, I'm very glad that this resurgence of interest in tradition and the monarchy and nationalism, because it's all part of resistance to what the globalists are trying to do. When you contrast it with the apathy for Gorbachev's funeral, where not even the president of Russia went to the Moscow funeral of Gorbachev, he had better things to do. And you contrast that with the worldwide focus on Queen Elizabeth. This has been a victory for resistance to the globalist new world order.